This is Luxury.
And Diallo,
the hosts of One Song. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this podcast and for giving our recording studio a sustainable makeover.
Just like music is made of notes and beats, each eco-friendly choice we make contributes a single note that completes the overall melody. That's why Heartbeat and U.S. Soy are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets.
To see our podcast studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 18 years from tonight, Grant Gill will become a comedy legend when he totally kills it at his improv class's graduation performance. Knees will be slapped. Hilarity will ensue. That's why he's already keeping himself in shape and razor sharp today with wellness tips and tools from AARP to help make sure his health lives as long as he does. Because the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/healthyliving.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we love to do one thing, and that's get inside the minds of brilliant comedians. Why? Well, because these are amazing minds. Why are they amazing minds? Well, because I'm one of them, and I feel like I got an amazing mind. So I feel like anybody that embraces comedy in some type of way, shape, or form has an amazing mind, too. Well, today's guest, he was on Last Comic Standing, his 2019 HBO special, The Great Depression, a recent role on 2019's The Joker, and guys, look out for him on his new date on his Peace of Mind tour. Also, he's got an upcoming book called K-12. Please show some love for Gary Goldman. What's up, Gary?
Thanks, Kevin Hart. It's an honor to work with you today. It's been a long time since we worked together.
It's been a very long time, man.
Yeah.
A very long. How many years? God.
I think it was the 2010 or 11 Just for Laughs in Montreal. It was.
I was going to say.
Maybe 2009.
Yeah, I was going to say 9. I was going to say 2009, yeah. Man. 2009.
Yeah, I think it was before The Big House. Is that possible?
You're right in. Well, I remember it was like my second Just for Laughs.
Oh, wow.
So I know it was, I think it was like in that 8 or 9 time period for sure.
Okay.
How you been, man?
I'm great. I'm thriving despite the pandemic and not having really got on stage in the past year. But I feel good mentally, physically. I've been really stroking it at the courts lately. Really, my jumper is as good as I remember it as it was in the 11th or 12th grade when I switched my game up. And then I've been working on a book, so that's really helpful as far as keeping my creativity flowing. That's been a godsend, man. If I didn't have that book deal, I would have lost my mind, I think.
Wow. Well, we're going to get into that, man, plus so much. Gary, you know, the first thing I want to say, where are you from? Gary?
Originally, I am from Peabody, Mass, which is a suburb of Boston, about 16 miles north of Boston, kind of a working class type area. Yeah.
And Gary, how long have you been doing comedy now?
It'll be 28 years on October 11th this year.
When you say that, how does that make you feel? When you go 28 years, 28 years you have been slinging jokes. Is that a good feeling for you?
It feels terrific, but mostly because I figured it out 2 or 3 years ago. About 25 years in, I finally felt I knew what I was doing as far as writing jokes, and that sounds just about right.
You know what, man? The reason why I said I was excited to talk to you, because one thing that is something that a lot of people know about comedians, you know, they say, you know, some comedians really go through it, some comedians suffer, some comedians are, you know, there's something behind that mask of funny for most. And it was one thing that, you know, I remember at a point in my life where I never really understood where it came from because of, you know, how I operated. And then I got to meet a lot of people that were in the business with us. And, you know, we do go through things. We go through a lot of things, and the way that we as comedians handle these things are different. And you, I know that Judd Apatow produced, he produced the Great Depression with you back in 2019, man. And you were extremely like vocal about what you went through, about what you were going through. And the thing that I want to get into is the discovery and reason behind you saying, you know what, this is something that I need to get out. This is something that I want to talk about. This is something that I want to bring awareness to. When do you feel like it started to really get to you within the craft?
Well, that's a great question, because I felt like early on, you're just figuring out how to swim, and you're treading water for for a year or so. There are very few guys who are funny immediately, or maybe they're funny immediately, but you look at them and they're like, these people are very, very green, and they have a long way to go, but they have a spirit in them and a certain likability. And I think I had that from the get-go, but I had no craft and I had no technique, and I didn't really know how to write a joke. And I would say after about 3 or 4 years, I figured out what I wanted to sound like on stage and moved towards that. But the thing that kept getting in my way was this sort of brain system that I would get easily discouraged, and my discouragement would just overwhelm me, and I would want to give up, and it would set me back months because I wasn't able to go up there with confidence or be as much of a hustler as I am naturally, and as much of a hard worker as I am, because I would just get in my head so much. So that was something that was sort of needling me over the years and make me operate maybe at 75%. And then at about 25 years, the depression that I suffered in 2017 was so severe that it wasn't even a matter of not performing at my best. It was not being able to really function as a human and as a person who was able to take care of themselves. Really, I was eking out a life, and that was something that I had to address. And so I addressed that. I went into the hospital. I had certain treatments that one of them was alarming to everybody when I brought it up. But one of the things that I wanted to get across in the special, in the Great Depression, I wanted to make people understand that the treatments are modern and they're effective and that they're not something to be afraid of. So that was important that I get that across. Then when I started to feel better, I still was not at 100%. I physically looked like somebody who was going through something. So I had a lot of nervous tics from anxiety and depression. I would bite my lip and I would shake, and I had to address it on stage. And I would say now, initially I was like, well, this is terrible. This is a real handicap. But as I look back on it, it was a godsend, because I had to address it on stage. I had to talk about depression, and the most comfortable way for me to talk about things that are heavier is through jokes and making fun of it and making light of it. So I think one of the first jokes that I was able to get across was, I got recognized in the psych ward by another patient from having been on probably Conan, or I think it was a Conan. I think it was a Conan appearance. And I remember as soon as he said, I won't say anything to anybody, I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but I'm a big fan. And I remember thinking, if I when I get out of here, this will be the joke that I tell if I'm ever able to address this on stage, because it was still something that I was like, nobody's going to want to hear about this. And then lo and behold, when I got back to doing comedy, it was something to say, listen, I just got out of the hospital. That's why I'm shaking. And I don't know raise your hand if you've ever been recognized in the psych ward from television. And that was a very easy joke, but it lightened the mood and allowed me to address things and get a little bit more specific. So that was really helpful.
I was going to say, more importantly, it helped you. You know, when you're talking about lightening the mood, I think, you know, as comics and, you know, as a comic that has has been vulnerable on stage and that has talked about things that some may not think one would dare to go into to find humor. For me, it was when my mother passed away. You know, I never really grieved and I never really truly embraced it. And, you know, my way of doing that was getting it to a space where I could make it some type of material, because that acted as my comfort space. And you know, as I talked about it, I found like a sense of relief in myself, and kind of like, okay, I needed to get this out. And this is the way for me that it made sense to get it out. My question for you, Gary, is, you know, it's not like you were a stranger to success in comedy. You know, you were thriving as a comedian, and, you know, you're still a fucking great comic. When you say it was the doubt, or, you know, not really thinking that you were in your own head about certain things, like, is this good enough or is it not? Did the audience play a factor in this ever, or was it just a thing of you versus you?
Yeah, that is a really good point. Not a lot of people have asked me about, but it's something that it's a symptom of depression, but it just feels like it's your brain telling you the truth. But your brain is saying you're worthless and these jokes are not original and you're talentless, and also your best years are behind you. I mean, that's the thing that I keep thinking about, is what a lucky position we're in, because I'm watching the NBA playoffs right now, and like, LeBron is in his mid-30s and he's a veteran. And I feel like with stand-up, when I got to my mid-30s, I really started to figure it out and get my get into a groove. And so we're really lucky that we can keep improving at this thing into our 50s 60s. I mean, guys like Carlin and Larry David and just people who are still active doing stand-up, it's really inspiring. But the thing was, is that my brain, it was exactly as you said, it was me against me. It was my brain saying, you're never going to write another good joke. And then so much pressure was put on every single show, so that I would get anxious. And I hadn't gotten anxious going on stage for spots, like New York spots, since I was in my 20s. And then all of a sudden I'm like, can I win this crowd over? And I can remember leaving and just walking around the village, just on the brink of tears, just thinking I've lost it. And I got great laughs, but the laughs felt like, well, they're laughing at things that I thought of when I was healthy 3 years ago or a year ago.
Always finding a thing to kind of grab onto.
Yeah, and that the new stuff didn't work, so I'm worthless and I'm never going to write another good joke. But what people who are in the midst of it don't understand is that's the role that the brain is playing in your life when it's been hijacked by depression. It's sort of a veil that's covering your face and telling you all these things that are really lies. But much like I have a real kinship with people who suffer from addiction, because it seems like their brain is telling them anything it can to win their mind over and say, oh, use again. And I feel like that with me, that my brain is telling me anything to, in my case, want to. I mean, I was suicidal, so I know it's grim, but that's the way I was thinking. My brain was telling me anything it could to make me not want to go on with life, and to be able to face that head on was not easy in those times. It was very helpful that I went into the hospital, because I felt I was a danger to myself at that point.
You say, I know it's grim. Let me tell you something, man. There's beauty in what you're saying and what you're doing, right? Because this experience that we're talking about, we're not aware of how many other people may be in the same thing or trying to figure out how to deal with the same thing. And what I'm gathering right now, just from this part of the conversation, is it's something that, you know, you've overcome the darkest side of it. Like, you're talking about going and getting help, and you're talking about, you know, the point where, yeah, we got to the point where I had suicidal thoughts, or I was a danger to myself. Like, well, you're talking about that right now. You're discussing it, which means that there's a sense of comfort in you now, and a strong evolvement. Like, you've evolved. You're past that point, and that's big. So, you know, I don't want you to feel like this is heavy or too heavy at all, because it's not. It's dialogue. It's conversation. It's real, and it's your experience and your story. When you say that you went through the things that you went through, did you have somebody that acted as somebody to talk to? Like, who were you talking to in this time?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really helpful, because I wanted to just highlight the role my wife Sade played in this, and she's featured in the documentary portion of the special I did, and she was really helpful in that she went to every appointment with my psychiatrist. So he was a very important person in helping me decide what kind of treatments I wanted to pursue and whether I would go into the hospital and just how I would handle my business. And he was very effective in convincing me in a very gentle way that I should check into the hospital. But my wife was there to ask the questions that I was either too out of my element asking, and in that I was very insecure about myself, and that's part of the depression. So I didn't feel like wasting this guy's time with asking him questions that I thought maybe weren't up to par as far as a doctor goes. And Sade would ask those questions for me. She was also doing a great deal of research on her own about all the treatments that were available and some of the treatments that I was doing. And the other thing was that she stood by me. We weren't married at the time. We had been going together for about 6 months, and it was a fantastic 6 months. And then the bottom fell out of my life, and she stuck by me, and
she stayed there.
Yeah, she stayed there. So she's ride or die, and I'm so grateful.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm so grateful for her, and I'm so happy that the past 3 years, almost 4 years, that I've been healthy, that we've been able to have the life that was sort of promised to her in the first 6 months, which is that I was a person who was enthusiastic and optimistic and hopeful, and by nature I'm not Pollyannish by any means, but I'm much more likely to advocate hope and believing in yourself than say any kind of cynical view or anything like that. I mean, that's one thing that draws me to your comedy on stage, of course, but also I remember seeing it. It may have been with Oprah, but it was a major thing where you had paintings of your heroes hung up in your home.
Oh, yeah. On my wall. Yeah.
Which is something that I've done since I was in high school, as far as back then it was Patrick Ewing and Larry Bird.
Wow.
But now it's other comedians that I love, and actors and activists that I love, and characters that inspire me. And so
it's inspiring.
Yeah. It's just that there are so many comedians who are cynical on stage and off stage, and I think they're dragging an anchor that's not really helpful.
You know what, man? Those pictures that I have on my wall, there's like a hallway. There's a hallway in my house, and you know, I put what I consider to be some of the comedy greats on my wall. And you know, they're in some of the most animated faces or cool poses.
Yeah.
But the reason why I have them in a hallway is because no matter what, I have to lock eyes with these pictures at some point.
Yeah.
And when I look at the success that they've had, when I look at what they've done, not just for themselves, but for the craft that I love, for the craft that, you know, I give so much to, it makes me be thankful, one. It makes me be thankful to be able to do what I do for a living. And for two, just to never have an excuse to put effort into the business of a joke.
Right.
Like, look at what can happen when you put the effort into the business behind a joke. This is a definition of that. So, you know, those pictures for me serve a valuable purpose. And, you know, everybody needs a little boost. Everybody needs a little push.
Oh, my gosh.
A push, yeah. A boost. It's much needed. Dude, I think that's your wife. Like, you saying the word ride or die, being there for you. That's fucking amazing, man. Good for you. Are you guys married now? Are you married? How long? I'm sorry. How long have you been married now?
We got married by Zoom during the pandemic.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So we've been together, I think, since 2014. And we've been married since October.
Wow. Why the pandemic wedding? How did that come about?
Because we had planned on doing it before the pandemic. And I kept referring to her as my wife. Like in the special, I thought by the end of the special, we would have been able to get married. So in the special, I referred to her as my wife. Also, partly, I didn't want people to think that this woman who put aside her life for me was being called a girlfriend. It just made me sound like a very selfish teenager. So I referred to her as my wife in the special. So we got it done over Zoom with four or five friends, and it was really meaningful. It was terrific.
That's dope. That's dope as hell. Yeah. Very intimate. An intimate Zoom wedding during the pandemic.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert. And I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert. And I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure. Because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Doers, mowing season is here with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
How did the pandemic, how was that on you? You know, after going through your journey, recovering and, you know, being put in the position where what our outlets once were are kind of taken and, you know, we're all kind of shut down. How was that? How did you go through that?
One, it was a great test of the stability of my recovery. So I kind of look at that as being grateful that no matter how things that I have no control over, no matter how bad they get, I can keep my head up. And the other thing was that I found through the Great Depression, I'm sure you've found this over the years, and it's a great byproduct of having some fame, which is that people reach out to you and share their story. Sometimes people will ask me for advice. And so I had a lot of opportunities to go on. I remember on the first day of the shutdown, I went on CNN to talk with their anchor, John Berman, about what you can do during a pandemic to maintain your mental health. And it was helpful for me also, though, because I had to make a list and say, well, what are the things I did to recover from my original depression? And what have I gotten lax with? And what are the things that I really have to augment or adhere to? I mean, one thing that happened during the early days of the pandemic was you were worried about how do I exercise, because exercise was mm-hmm. was one of the biggest keys to my recovery. And so I just kept saying, and my mantra was, I'll figure it out. And that's been so helpful. And also I just think that so many people who maybe didn't address their mental health needs were sort of forced into it by this crucible that was the pandemic. So I think just like what you're saying with the grieving process with your mom, there's sort of these things where you can, I always think of this quote by Mark Twain, you can make yourself feel better by making others feel better. And I really think that's part of our evolution. I don't think it's a coincidence that you I know you've done this for so many comedians over the years, but and it's really nice to be thought of as the guy who helps out, but it also, it really feels great to help somebody get on TV and to, I don't get as excited as I once did doing a 5-minute spot, but I get just as excited getting this young kid on a TV series or more likely just a 5-minute spot and helping them grow in that way because they're so excited and so grateful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you say that, it's weird because there's joy in finding joy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I truly do believe that. There's a lot of joy that comes from finding joy, bringing other people joy, or acting as a segue to it. You know, I believe that happiness can be contagious.
Yes.
I believe that is something that, you know, if you choose to pass on, people have the option to take it and then pass it on. It's like a baton,
yeah,
if you want it to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, I identify with what you're saying strongly because it's something that I find a tremendous amount of happiness in when I'm able to do for others or you know, help catapult other people into any type of success or, you know, making the connections for people when they in a, you know, business relationship aspect, just anything where I feel like I can help. I definitely try my best to do. When you talk about the pandemic, right, and you're saying like, you know, you were able to go back and use the things that you practiced and kind of get into your mantra of what you once did and it helped you move forward and get past it. Let's get back to talking about stand-up now.
Yeah.
Right? Like, shit, it's been a minute since we've been able to be active and really get up, get out in front of crowds. How do you feel like your journey towards that stage now is going to be? As we go back, do you feel like it's a tough one? Do you feel like it'll be easier? What's your mindset going into comedy now?
I mean, I was very fortunate in the position I was in when the lockdowns started. So I was in the middle of a tour that I had written the hour and a half for this tour in between finishing the Great Depression and it airing. And then I went on this tour and I still have like 2 months of dates left where I'll use that material. And then I have a separate tour from that. So I'll be able to work out this new stuff also in the city, living in New York, as it opens up, I'll be able to work out this stuff and I'll be able to stretch out this material. I mean, the thing I always...
I'm laughing because I'm laughing at the smile, like just hearing you talk about it. Like,
yeah.
Like you're laughing, talking about just getting up, the tour, the next material. That's why I'm laughing.
That's the one thing since I started that it was a blessing that I always recognized. The only thing I really have control over is my notebook and how much I'm writing every day. And I mean it, you have to write every day. I could be argued out of not writing every day, but for me, maybe it's a compulsion, but I need to write every day. And the other thing that I have in my inventory of things to inspire me is that I haven't watched The Last Dance yet.
Mm.
On Netflix. So I get to see the hardest working man in the history of the hardest sport to get really good at.
You have not seen it yet. Wow.
No, I wanted to save it until my next tour so that I would be inspired to leave it all out there and put in the work necessary. So I'm just, I've held off and I've heard how good it is. And once I start working on the tour and going out, I'll watch it and I predict a really great special will come out of this type of discipline, because that's one thing. There was the mania of competition that Jordan is known for, but there was also the discipline in his workouts and his training, and that I feel really, really makes the difference.
You will You are going to be blown away by the last. I mean, listen, it's so good. It's so good because it just showed how Michael was so different.
Yes.
He's so different, right? And you know, the energy and effort that he put into the craft of basketball and his competitiveness, you know, that's what you're going to take from. Like, there was a competitive nature,
yeah,
but also how he used it, you know, how he used his competitive nature to try to motivate and amplify the personalities around him. It's interesting. You're going to, you're in for an amazing treat,
yeah,
especially as a basketball fan, one, but as a person that's just looking for, you know, just some added oomph to add to your, you know, attack on what you're about to do. It's going to serve an amazing purpose for you. I'm telling you, it's good.
There was something I want to ask you, and I've been holding on to this for weeks now.
Please.
I watch you play basketball on TV, and you're a basketball player. You're not a celebrity who plays,
yes,
basketball. It's you're a basketball,
yes,
player. And as you know, basketball is one of those sports where you can't just be athletic. You have to put a lot of effort and time into, especially,
absolutely,
especially shooting and ball handling. So I found over the years that the same sort of devotion and discipline regarding becoming a good basketball player served me so well in comedy. Just the going out every night and doing the shows and spending as much time practicing for the show as I was doing the show even more. And I wonder if you could speak to that, because I can't,
yes,
I don't think it's a coincidence that you're an excellent basketball player and a master comedian.
Listen, it's, you're talking about reps. I mean, you,
yes,
know, when you're equating the world of jump shots, you're equating the world of drills, basketball handling drills, jump shot drills, you're equating, you know, at a certain level how they're analyzing a playbook and watching tape on their opponent and what they're playing. There's hours that go into being good at the thing that you're choosing to be good at. And, you know, for me in stand-up comedy, I was in New York, this is no exaggeration, I was a consistent 4 to 5 spot a night guy. I,
yeah,
was a consistent, you know, during the week, you're looking at, I'll say my Monday through Thursday, you're probably looking at 20 shows between those days. You're looking at 20, and then that weekend, you know, that's where you were making your money. So the weekend,
yeah,
in New York, you know, I was popping 6 to 7. And doing it, A, to get the reps, but because that's what I felt the hustle was. That's how I really felt the energy of New York City. It was getting in and out of a cab, closing the door, running to my spot, doing the spot, getting off the stage, getting in another cab. I got to be in my next spot in 20 minutes. It felt so good to say, I got another spot.
Yeah.
I got another spot. And for me, Gary, that was something that I didn't want to lose sight of. I didn't want to not respect that. So I made sure to hold on to that. And now, even at this point in my career, when it's time to get in the gym, when it's time to go back in the season, like since we're using the basketball analogy, when it's time to get back in the gym and back in the weight room because you got a season that's coming up, well, you know, I go back to New York. I go back to New York and I get my skeleton, and then I start going to like comedy clubs that are on the outskirts, and I'll go do about 15 shows at a comedy club from Monday through Thursday or Monday through Friday, and then I'll go back home for the weekend until I get my hour. But it takes me about a year to get that next hour of just putting that practice time in, because because it's something that I'm as mental about it as you were referring to, just about wanting it to be right. I want it to be right. And I try not to be so hard on myself, although I do understand how that can be a thing, because you're what we were talking about earlier, you're judging yourself to you. It's you against you. So, you know, you got to play a weird game as to what's the right amount of expectation to have from you? What's the ease point? What's the comfortable point, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's a great, it's a great formula. I love the New York spots and then the going to the club and knocking the rust off. It's great.
When you tour, a typical tour for you lasts how long? And by the way, your tour now, I love the name of it, you know, A Peace of Mind. I love what you're calling it. You know, it's strong. It's a strong, like, it's a strong stance as to what you've been through, where you've come from, and now what this represents. I love that.
Oh, thanks.
How long does your tours normally last?
I would say it usually starts in the fall in September or October, and then I go till April or May, and it's usually between 2 and 4 weekends a month, sometimes 3, sometimes 4, sometimes 2. And then I mean, the thing I always think about with these tours is just how, I mean, naming it Peace of Mind is sort of a signal to the audience who was so I guess patient or believed in me enough to say, okay, we're going to listen to this guy talk for an hour and a half about being depressed and being hospitalized and having some distressing treatments. So this type of round, to reward them, it's less heavy. There are no breakdowns or suicidal ideations or anything like that to discuss. It's still biographical, but it's lighter. So I wanted people to know about that. But I like to be on tour for 6 months. I feel I've heard Carlin talking about this over the years, and the guys from Monty Python. There are times to inhale, which is to create and think and write and do some spots. And then there's some times to you exhale and you put it all out there and you perform. And I wonder if you find this, that every night is sort of like this full on dress rehearsal where I'm giving it my all, but also there's this looseness of, if I go on an improvisation or fool around for a few minutes, I don't feel like I'm wasting an entire crew, camera crew's time or a director's time by doing this. And that freedom, it really works. Just that permission to fail or that permission to take big risks is pays off so well down at the end of the tour when hopefully at this point I can say, well, I'll put it on a special. Before, it used to be, I'll put it on an album, and there's so much freedom there, and I think that spawns creativity, and I'm so grateful that my career is at a level where that's a thing, where I don't have to kill so hard in front of the headliner that they bring me back as the headliner. I can be a little bit less competitive in that nature, and also know that my fans are patient enough and can say that well, he went off track for 10 minutes there, but it paid off. So I'm really grateful for that.
Yes.
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
You know, I remember when you were on your touring days, and you were a part of, I believe you were with Bobby Kelly.
Yeah.
You know, Bobby Kelly, Dane. Who else was on that tour with you guys? It was you, Bobby, Dane. I think I'm missing one person. But I remember back then when you guys were touring, right? When at that time, back then, how was your mind then? Were you having any swings then? With you, your thoughts in that space as well?
Yeah.
And were any of them aware?
Well, I don't think people were aware because I wasn't comfortable talking about it. I didn't want to scare everybody off. I was convinced that people would be put off by it. And I think that's another lesson that I learned about life and friends, is that you can expect more from your friends than you might think you are entitled to. I guess I sold them short, because when it came time to share this with them, they were all open and supportive and encouraging. But I remember one thing that wasn't helpful was that I was viewing myself in terms of the difference in fame level between myself and Dane at that time. He was this juggernaut and filling arenas, and I was still struggling to get headlining spots in clubs that were next door to Spencer Gifts and Cheesecake Factory. So it was a big difference, and instead of saying, well, I'm on my own path, I was comparing myself, and I mean, I stole this from my friends in AA, but there's this expression, compare and despair. And it was just, it was driving me crazy. I'm a competitive person. I never think of myself as a jealous person. And I was having to tell myself that you're still a good comedian. Just because you're not famous and you're not selling out all these arenas and colleges, you're still a strong comedian, and the people are appreciating you. And it was really difficult to get through that in my head, because it was part of the depression. You feel insecure when you're depressed, because your brain is telling you all the time that you're worthless. So that was really hard. And also that when you don't have your routines, so I wasn't able to run every day or play basketball every day. I was on a bus every day going from town to town, and I didn't have my safety net and my life around me. So that was very difficult. But I think it's something that I've learned in touring, and you must go through this too. It's grueling to be on tour for a long time. The travel can really be invasive in your family life, but also as far as your sleep habits and eating right. And I learned to be completely vigilant about my moods and what I was putting into my body, how much sleep I was getting, but also promising myself I would exercise every day on the road, because it's even more necessary when you're not in your home environment to try and maintain every routine that keeps you alive and flourishing.
Well, the key thing that you said was learned, you know, like it's something that it's acquired. Like you don't know off the back, right? Nobody tells you how grueling the tour life is going to be. Nobody tells you that this is the definition and meaning of the road. And you're just thrown into it. And it's every day it's the same, but it's like not the same. You know, you're losing more and more sleep as it goes on. You're waking up at wee hours of the night to travel to the next place. And like you said, if there's a tour bus, sleeping on that road and journey from this destination to this, you get there. When you get there, you're in a hotel, but you're not really in a hotel for long. Shower, change, do the show. Depending on where you are, you may stay at a hotel that night or you may not. You may have to get on a plane and go home. It's like there is a crazy toll that it plays on your body. And luckily early on I discovered that. I remember when I was on stage, and like it was like 2009. This is 2009, maybe going into 10, and this is around Seriously Funny. And I remember being out of breath on stage. I remember like really gasping for air. And I was like, oh shit, like this is taking a toll. Like I'm winded from performing. I'm winded. And I said, this isn't good.
Yes.
This isn't a good thing. I'm doing like back-to-back shows. And I use so much energy on stage. If I can't if I can't get through this and I get to the next show and I'm worn out, these shows will progressively get worse. And then I looked at everything I was eating. I was throwing a bunch of shit in my body just all day, every day. And I said, this is going to have to change if I want the best out of me in this space. And I kind of got a hold of it early. I got a nice hold of it.
Yeah, I always try to figure out what would be really difficult to do for an hour or an hour and a half, however long my shows are. And I should be able to do that so that I make the doing the stand-up just something easy. I just have to talk for 90 minutes. I don't have to, like, I got really into long distance running. I don't have to run in the rain or in the cold. I just have to talk for 90 minutes. And it reminds me, I played college football, and if I got nothing else out of it, but the fact that we used to have to wake up at 5:30 in the morning to pretty much you ran till you puked. I mean, it was just a disgusting effort. But I remember for the rest of college and the rest of my life, I would say, I will never do anything harder than this. To just get up and go to class at 9 a.m. is so much easier than running until I'm sick at 5:30 in the morning. And as much as I resented it, it was this great lesson and proof to myself that I could do something really difficult. And just over the years, things that a lot of people would complain about, getting up for an early flight. It's like, I don't have to run and jump. I just have to show up to this flight on time and check my bag. And it's just I found that to be a really helpful sort of life hack, I guess.
When you say you got into long distance running, how long were you running?
I mean, 10 miles was sort of the long day of the week. So it was usually a 4-mile. And then the longest one was about 10 miles. And that was, I mean, that was integral to my recovery. I really believe that. And at first I would have to run and listen to books or podcasts. I would spend the hour in my head thinking disaster and catastrophe. And then eventually I took back my mind from the depression, and I would create while I was running. I mean, so many great ideas come to you when you only have your pace and your heart and things like that. It's helpful. You can listen to books and podcasts and get information, but I think creatively we're programmed to think and get rid of the boredom on our own. And that's why I think so many people have so many great ideas in the shower, because it's one of the last places where nobody can get to us.
Running is so valuable. It was so valuable. I don't do the long distance that much anymore. It was getting tough on my knees. Like concrete, it gets tough. So, you know, I pulled back from the amount that I was, I guess you could say weekly. There was a moment where I was putting miles in because I was training for marathons, right?
And
I was really running. But during those runs, the sound of your heartbeat, the sound of just of nothing, and your feet hitting the pavement, It put such a zenning calm, such a nice calm. I remember like coming back from runs and it was just a reset. It was like a nice reset.
Yeah.
Like I'm ready for my day. Like it's you got comfortable with the pace and you ran that pace for a while. You come back and it's like I'm ready for my day. Like I'm ready to attack the week or whatever, man. And it's, you know, it's something I still do. I just don't, I'm like a 2 to 5 mile guy now, you know?
Yeah. It's perfect. Yeah. The truth is that a half hour
it's perfect.
Is fine. Even 15 minutes
perfect.
Is
it's funny.
Great.
We just
got
keep
into
getting
this
lower.
Thing where
5 minutes.
Where I wanted to.
What? I said, we just keep getting lower. Started off 10 miles, 30 minutes, 15, two, well, 2 minutes at the end of the day.
I don't want to intimidate the people who are like, well, if I can't run 10 miles, it's not worth it. It is worth it. And whatever amount of time you put in, you get back in energy and that spirit that you get. I mean, I never got that runner's high, but I always felt better mentally, sharper and more positive after I ran than before, and significantly. Like I think at a certain level of stability in my mental makeup, or once my depression lifted, I was getting a bigger boost from the run than I was any kind of antidepressants. The antidepressants got me to a level where I could run, and then the run was taking me to a level where I was actually just, I mean, I feel that way now. I'm so in love with life. And there was a time less than 5 years ago where I was like, I don't know that I could, how much longer I can face this. It's such anguish. And so I mean, I can't tell you how grateful I am for that.
Well, let's celebrate where you are now. I mean, you know, we know where you've come from, and I love once again that you're so vocal about it and telling your story. And I hope our listeners can really understand like how important this is. You know, mental health is highlighted now. There's a spotlight on it because you have more people speaking up about what so many felt like they had to handle on their own. And I myself, I've grown to respect and appreciate those brave enough that are going through mental health issues that have voiced them, because you're making us all aware. And the more that we can be aware, the more that we can lend a helping hand where we possibly can. And sometimes it's just being a voice of positivity. Sometimes it's being support. Sometimes it's giving a shoulder. And, you know, in your case, Gary, talking about how your wife was there for you and stood there with you through it all. Like, you know, that's important. It's such a beautiful thing to hear. And I love that you're writing the book. I love that you're getting back to stand up. I love that you're now finding new life in life. I love it. And I think this is where you now shine. This is where you shine. And you fucking go and you do what you do best. You're a fucking great comic, man. You're a great comic. You always have been. And I'm happy to say that, like, we'll get to see you be you. I'm happy to say, like, you know, coming out of this pandemic, you're going to go and get back to being you. And that's a beautiful thing, man. The guy that you fucking are, the comic that you are. And that's my truth to you, man. This is dope as hell to hear you just say the things that you said and talk how you've talked through this goddamn podcast. I love it.
Well, that's really nice to hear. And I think, you know, that when the audience laughs, likes us, it's nice. We love it. But what really does it for me at this point is when other comedians have reached out and said positive things, and it feels so great, because I know just from the paintings you have, the reverence you have for the shoulders we're all standing on, and to be embraced by them is just that's really priceless. It's so valuable to me. So I can't thank you enough for this.
I mean it, man. We're a fraternity. I say it so much, you know, as comics, it's not about the competition. It's about the doors that we're constantly opening. And through those doors, more of our peers can come through and open up other doors. You know, it's something that continues to grow. There's nothing better than a laugh, which is why it will always be needed. I don't care what anybody says. Yeah. A laugh will always be needed. And we provide that. That's what we provide. That's why we're valuable. We're an asset. We're an asset to life. We're an asset to feel good. That's how I look at it, man. And, you know, I'm never going to change that mindset. And I'm a comics comic. I love comics. I love comedy. That's why I do this podcast. I get to talk to all of you guys and just have real conversation, man. And today's conversation was no different. It was dope as hell, man. I'm glad.
I appreciate it.
I'm glad you did it. I'm glad that you're in a great space, Gary. And I can't wait to hear more from you, man. And I love that you're kicking this thing's ass and helping those that may be going through it. I love that you're giving them, you know, some information. I love that you're giving them some motivation to understand that they too can get past it and they too can weather that storm. So, dude, this is Comedy Gold Mines. And today, what an amazing mind we got in. Ladies and gentlemen, please, goddamn, say hello but not goodbye. Gary, because they're about to see you again soon, man. He's got a tour. It's called the Peace of Mind Tour. Gary, the book. What's going on with the book? When, where, how?
The book is through Flatiron Books, a division of Macmillan Books. It'll be out. I mean, it'll probably be out in 2023, but it's called K through 12, and it's a memoir. I have a blessing and a curse of a memory of my entire life since I was 5 years old. So I have stories in it, and it's funny, but there are also, of course, moments in every kid's life that at least at the time feel really heavy and sad. So it's a combination, and I'm very, very proud of the work I've done so far, but also it's a great feeling to see yourself in it. And it's like in comedy and in basketball where you put in the effort every day and you see improvements and things get easier. And I just hope people can, I always think about this. There've been certain things in my life where I think when I first started doing it, it was so hard and I never thought I would be able to do it. And now I do it without thinking. And this is something that we should keep reminding ourselves that we've overcome so many obstacles and things we thought we were in over our heads and we didn't give up and we made it through.
I love it. I love it. Ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks.
Gary Goldman, man. Comedy Gold Mines, where we get inside the minds of brilliant comedians. And why? Because what amazing minds they are. Today's mind was no different. Thank you again, Gary.
Thanks, brother. It was great seeing you.
You as well.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.
Doers, mowing season is here with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas-like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas-like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.